think the key point I want to make is that very unlike the situation in the late, in the early 1980s, where you had, or late 1970s, where you had what is called stagflation, slow economic growth, if not negative economic growth, as well as high rate of inflation in the West, but rapid economic growth in Latin America, in East Asia, and in some other parts of the South. This kind of bifurcation, if you will, is something which is now of the distant past as a consequence of the very intense process of globalization which has taken place over the last three decades. So the fate of most developing countries, unlike in that earlier period, is very much linked to what has been happening in the developed economies. And this, of course, means that we are all going down together, contrary to those people who are claiming that developing countries in the South have basically delinked. The situation last year, and more importantly, our forecasts for this year are rather pessimistic, as you can see from this table. And economies in transition, of course, are the most badly hit. But I would also draw your attention to the fact that developing economies are also rather adversely hit. And this collapse in growth rate, particularly for countries, say, in sub-Saharan Africa, which had only experienced half a decade or so of rapid growth, is particularly of great concern because, as we all know, poverty reduction and improvement of the human lot requires not only redistribution but also an improvement in growth. Now, the situation this year is rather is going to be rather bad, despite all this recent talk about green shoots. We expect that over 100 countries will experience recession this year, of which 60 will be developing countries and another 14 are transition economies. Food prices have come down, as you know, from their high in the first half of 2008, but they will still be much higher than they used to be in the earlier period, for example, in the first half of this decade. The trade impacts generally of this recession will affect all developing countries, and particularly primary exporters will suffer from the collapse in the terms of trade, especially for minerals, but also for agricultural products more generally. Trade surpluses and reserves are being run down very quickly. The only silver lining, if you will, are lower energy as well as food prices. Now, aid flows in the recent past have been notoriously unreliable and, as you know, largely concentrated for political reasons in a number of countries. If you look at the list of the top five aid recipients, these are all politically determined, countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, Colombia, Israel, and Egypt. Now, remittances are expected to decline. The recent reports suggest a much more complicated pattern, some improvement in increase in remittances for countries like Bangladesh and the Philippines, but a more significant drop in remittances, for example, to the Caribbean. These early projections by the World Bank are probably quite outdated by now. The social impacts, as predicted by different groups, are again rather problematic. The ILO used early IMF projections on growth as of November last year to suggest that 200 million more people will slip into the ranks of the working poor and that unemployment will rise by over 50 million. But the recent projections by the ILO are rather different from these earlier projections, and suggest that perhaps the basis for making many of these projections are themselves very much in doubt. The ILO projections, the MDGs, the internationally agreed development goals, and social spending in general are at great risk, and the likelihood of growing social and political unrest are so significant that the US intelligence community have come to a consensus that the crisis poses the greatest security risk, not only to the world, but also to the United States. The social impacts are very uneven. Many of them, as you can imagine, women, children, and older people and are more adversely affected, and there are a whole range of issues which I don't have time to elaborate on, but my colleagues probably will do so. We also find that there has been a failure of multilateralism, if you will, a failure of international cooperation. Our own projection suggests that if there was greater coordination at the international level, in other words, you had a globally coordinated stimulus effort, everybody would be better off, and the world would also be significantly better off as represented by the red line. As you can see from these four graphs, developed countries would also be better off, and economies in transition as well as developing countries in general will be better off, but the least developed countries stand to benefit the most from a globally coordinated transition. For those of you interested in this, I would refer you to the last World Economic Situation and Prospects for the mid-year 2009. Now, one of the major problems, of course, is that output recovery, the relationship between output recovery and job recovery notoriously lags. As you can see, in the last recession, as far as the West and the U.S. was concerned, the recovery involved took about 4 years in the job market, whereas output recovery was achieved in about 8 months. Now, this the situation in different parts of the world is very difficult to assess, but the any lag in the recovery effort also results in an exponential increase in recovery prospects, as suggested by these this bar chart. Now, as you all know, social spending has always been a relatively low priority, especially for countries with very limited fiscal space, namely most developing countries, but also arguably many transition economies. Social transfers have, at least in the OECD countries, been extremely important, as you can see in this in these bar charts. Poverty risk has been significantly reduced by social protection transfers, especially in the OECD countries. Even in developing countries, social transfers have been important. In South Africa, for instance, it has been argued, in South Africa, we find that that has been a significant impact, largely attributable to social transfers. Because, as you know, the growth and employment policies have not generated as much in terms of jobs as would be desirable. Reducing poverty obviously requires, on the one hand, employment generation, but also other types of progressive fiscal policies, including social transfers, and have been helped by remittances. There was great concern going into this crisis that remittances may not help this time around. In the Asian crisis, for example, remittances actually increased during the Asian crisis, partly because East Asian workers abroad responded to the crisis by increasing their remittances because they still held their jobs. It was expected that this would be different this time round because many of these workers are themselves, overseas workers are themselves losing their jobs. If you look at what has been happening in the Middle East, if you look at what has been happening in the West and so on and so forth, it is often the migrant workers who are the first to lose their jobs and so on and so forth. But the recent reports, at least for Bangladesh and the Philippines, which both have a considerable number of overseas workers, suggest that that there has been, at least so far, a positive response by migrant workers to try to increase their remittances. Now, the cash transfer schemes have, as you know, have been expanding in developing countries. This is a subject of great deal of, of controversy, and there are several controversies involved, and I think we should sort out the different controversies. But one important controversy, of course, is whether one should make such cash transfer schemes conditional. And there is a whole debate as where the UN position tends to favor universality rather than conditionality and targeting. But the whole question of targeting and conditionality take on a different implications in the context of cash transfer schemes. So one key issue, I think, going forward is the whole question of the of whether or not such conditionality might be desirable, and particularly in the context of targeting as far as cash transfer schemes are concerned. Developing countries have undertaken significant cash social transfer programs. Over 25 developing countries are involved, involving about 200 million people right now. And the poverty impact, as I've suggested earlier, have been quite significant, for instance, in the case of South Africa, but also in some other places. And in the case of Mexico, as we have heard from Senora Garcia, as well as in Brazil, there seems to be a significant impact in terms of reducing poverty. There's other types of conditional social transfers, for example, requiring children to go to school, especially girl children to go to school, and also freeing up women to do more care work. Which is often compromised is a very important issue which needs to be considered. Likewise, with health care provisions, especially in societies where access to health care facilities is limited. Now, old age pensions, as you all know, actually support all household members, not simply the age population. And the World Economic and Social Survey, which our department produces, focused on this question of aging a couple of years ago. And we basically argue that the amount required to enhance transfers to older people, which will in turn benefit their families, is actually a relative, a modest transfers would actually involve a relatively small proportion of GDP. Thinking more seriously about the old age question is very important, not only because in developed economies there has been a significant demographic transition, but this demographic transition is becoming very apparent in developing countries as well. And particularly in Africa, where the ravages of AIDS has been serious, there are important questions of dependency which need to be considered. Now, as I mentioned earlier, developing countries can afford social protection. This is a debate which we might want to get into. And we have, as I mentioned earlier, suggested that a dollar a day type of provisioning for older people is quite affordable, even for some of the poorest countries in the world. Now, the larger question of affordability and financing is quite an important issue, and one of the important issues which has been raised not only at the Financing for Development Conference at Doha at the end of last year, but also 2 weeks ago at the UN conference on the crisis and the impact of the crisis, has been to try to enhance the role of the United Nations, and particularly to try to move towards perhaps a tax commission. Now, this is a very important issue because, as you know, the fiscal capacity of most developing countries is very, very badly compromised by tax competition, a sort of race to the bottom, if you will, with beggar my neighbor type of tax competition. And the only way to reverse this trend is through cooperation. Developed countries will also stand to benefit. developed countries, it has been shown, have also suffered a lot from tax from tax evasion. The scandal in Liechtenstein last year suggested that 4,000 of the highest taxpayers in the U.S. as well as in Germany were successfully avoiding tax. Now, the rhetoric at the London conference in early April is quite promising. It declared, for example, that the era of banking secrecy is over. However, when it came to focusing on tax havens, the focus was on offshore tax havens, ignoring completely the problem of onshore tax havens. And so the whole relationship between finance and the rest of the real economy, and particularly the fiscal relationship, was not fundamentally addressed. But let us hope that this declaration that the end of banking secrecy is nigh is something which we can, through the international community, can press hard on to ensure that we move towards a much greater tax cooperation. There is, I must emphasize, considerable resistance. And the resistance, I have to acknowledge, comes largely from the OECD. The OECD has done some useful work on tax issues. But right now, the problem arises because it seeks to resist a truly inclusive multilateral type cooperation, but rather would prefer to set the terms for tax cooperation through the OECD, which, as you all know, is an exclusive rich countries group. Now, enhancing fiscal resources, I think you're all very familiar with what needs to be done, progressiveness, et cetera, so I will not go into that right now. I think also that you're all very familiar with what has happened in response to the crisis, and particularly the initiative of the President of the General Assembly, whose office is right next door, in convening the conference held 2 weeks ago was very significant. Among other things, he also established a commission led by Professor Stiglitz, and the commission's report, commission issued preliminary recommendations in January, the interim report was made available at the beginning of last month. And I believe that the final report should be completed before the end of this month. Now, the final point I would like to make is that the need for to ensure that the processes going forward are inclusive is not unimportant. The President of the General Assembly emphasized that the effort going forward should be one involving the G192, referring to the member states of the United Nations. The current processes involving the G20 are not unimportant. They certainly are very important, but they are exclusive. And I think in this regard, we have to look back at what happened at Bretton Woods 65 years ago. At Bretton Woods 65 years ago, the Bretton Woods Conference 65 years ago was held largely thanks to the initiative of President Roosevelt. The position of the Churchill government was to have a bilateral arrangement between the US and the UK, the rising imperial power and the declining imperial power. They were not interested in having everybody else. But thanks to the Roosevelt administration's insistence, 44 countries participated. These 44 countries included 28 countries which would now be deemed developing countries. There were other countries which participated, such as the Soviet Union, which was rather supportive of the developing countries. What was the outcome? The outcome, as you all know, was to envisage an international the governance of international economy in terms of the IMF, the World Bank, and the International Trade Organization, which was subsequently vetoed by the U.S. Congress. The International Trade Organization would have provided the third prop of this kind of economic multilateralism, which was conceived as part of the UN system. The Bretton Woods Conference, I want to emphasize, was called, the official name of the Bretton Woods Conference was the United Nations Conference on Monetary and Financial Affairs. even though the United Nations organization did not exist in 1944. It was only in 1945 that it was created at San Francisco. But it was clear that the League of Nations and other multilateral arrangements had clearly failed, and it was necessary to develop a much more inclusive multilateral system. Those negotiations envisage a situation where creating the conditions for monetary and financial stability. That was a very important part of the Bretton Woods outcome. But it also saw its responsibility as creating the conditions for ensuring post-war economic reconstruction and for sustaining growth as well as employment. And finally, it also saw an important role for this new framework in creating the conditions for post-war development. I think that kind of broader vision is extremely important, because the current discussions which are taking place among the G7 or the G8 or the G20 are really concerned about restoring the conditions of financial stability, but not concerned about creating the conditions for sustained growth and employment, let alone the conditions for sustainable development. Thank you very much.